Welcome to the, what is this, April 16th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. I ask you to please rise and join us in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Before we get into our meeting this morning, I would ask everybody, in light of what happened yesterday in Boston, our neighbors and friends back there, family members, that we have a moment of silence. Please bow our head and think about those who are less fortunate. Thank you. Supervisor Hill, you had comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we had just a couple of weeks ago a marathon here in our community, the Slow Marathon, which was quite a successful and good event for the community, which is also a qualifier for the Boston Marathon. So I know that a lot of folks in our community are very concerned about what occurred in Boston yesterday, and I know that there were a lot of folks that from our community that participated in the Boston Marathon. So I believe all of us share the same sentiments in our thoughts and prayers going to the folks in Boston right now.
Thank you. Hearing devices are available. If you need them, get them from the clerk. Madam Clerk, are there any changes to the agenda?
Yes. Amendment number one to the April 16th board agenda. Addendums to the agenda. Item number 5, request to approve an agreement with AEG Cycling for services related to the Tour of California Bicycle Race Stage 5 finish in Avila Beach. Item number 6, request to authorize a budget adjustment in the amount of $71,402 in Fund Center 141, Agricultural Commissioner, to add expenditures offset by unanticipated revenue, and to amend the fixed asset list to add a replacement photocopier. Item number 18, request to approve a fiscal year 2013-14 renewal employment contract with James Vogue in the amount of $137,280 annually to serve as the commissioner of the Sheriff's Professional Standards Unit. Clarification. The above revisions to the subject lines were inadvertently posted to the website on Thursday, April 11th at 8 a.m. This addendum to the agenda is correcting the subject lines that were on the agenda posted on Tuesday, April 9th at 11 a.m. The agenda in the display case at the County Government Center is the original agenda posted on Tuesday, April 9th at 11 a.m. Addendum to item number 2, Atascadero Library bid opening. Amend the subject line to add the bid opening date of Thursday, May 16th, 2013. Item number 3, Sky Lantern Ordinance Introduction. Amend the subject on the staff report to read, Introduction of an Ordinance Amending Chapter 16.10 of the San Luis Obispo County Code to prohibit the ignition and launching of sky lanterns, with an exception in the unincorporated areas of San Luis Obispo County that are protected by the County Fire Department. Hearing date is set for May 7th, 2013. Further amending the recommended action in the staff report to read, it is recommended that the board set May 7th, 2013 as the date for a public hearing on an ordinance amending Chapter 16.1.
Mike Brown and Lindy Owen.
Good morning, Supervisors. I'm Grenda Ernst from the Atascadero Friends of the Library. And what I have to say this morning amounts to a footnote on item 2 on the consent agenda. I don't think that I will change any minds. But I think what I have to say is important in terms of the viewpoint of the not only the Friends of the Library, but the people of Atascadero. We began our campaign to expand the library in April 2009. And since that time, we've raised an astonishing $1,417,678. I think I said that wrong. We've raised a lot of money. And we've had tremendous support from the community. We have 165 founders, people that have raised between $1,000 and $3,000 for us, 30 business founders. We have 16 patrons, $3,000 to $5,000, and we have 28 major donors who have given over $5,000. In December 2010, when it became possible for us to buy the building that we're now going to use for the library in partnership with the library, it also became apparent that if we raised money carefully and quickly, we would be able to have enough money to start construction of the library and have construction finished in 2013, which is a Atascadero centennial. And this was really a rallying cry for the community who responded to that idea, responded to the idea that we're going to have a library in the downtown core of Atascadero, which will be part of Atascadero's revitalization. As the end of 2012 approached, it was apparent that we wouldn't have quite enough money, and you were kind enough to extend our deadline for raising the money to June of this year. However, we knew we wouldn't need that much money, that much time. At the beginning of December, we needed $130,000. Between December and mid-February, we asked the community to come to our aid, and they did indeed. We raised $119,000 in that 2.5 month period. 340 individuals or groups contributed to that effort. And one of the main reasons they were so interested in doing so was that everybody liked the idea of a library that was being completed in 2013. So now we're becalmed. We're doesn't look like that's going to happen. And there's been a lot of feeling about that in Atascadero. Many people have spoken to me about their disappointment in that, and I wanted you to know that. I think that that's important for you to know as the county government officials. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Ernst. Eileen O'Grady, followed by Jim Patterson.
Good morning. My name is Eileen O'Grady. I'm Vice President of Friends of the Library, and for the past 2 years, I have been 4 years rather, I've been coordinating a fundraising campaign to raise the money that Grenda talked about. 2 years ago, a partnership was created between the county and Friends of the Library to create the new Atascadero Library. Last month, our very hardworking volunteers held an event that raised $95,000 for this project. And at the event, we told our community that construction would soon begin. 1 week later, we were told the project would be rebid, we would not be opening this year, and we still haven't received a clear and convincing explanation for this decision. In fact, the letter we received at that point gave no explanation for that decision. These are some of our questions. Was the portion of the bid being protested crucial? Were there violations of the state contracting code? When the protest was originally filed, why was Friends of the Library told it was based on a technicality? Why was the protest declined initially and then reversed? If the low bid was deficient in some substantial way, why wasn't the project awarded to someone else? Why rebid it and delay the project for several months? And finally, how will fairness and maximum participation be ensured if the project is rebid? As Grenda alluded to, we've experienced a number of losses as a result of this decision. Number one in our minds is the loss of community enthusiasm based on opening the library in our centennial year. There's also been a loss of credibility and trust in the county. And from my perspective, an equally great loss is the loss of fundraising potential. Right now, we should have been in construction, and our community was excited about that. They would still be donating. Donations have ceased, and I don't know that we'll ever recover. Some of our concerns going forward is the transparency issue. In some cases, our local media received more information.
I'm here this morning to express my frustration with this latest delay in the construction of the Atascadero Library and One Stop. it's been a long process, and certainly this isn't the first obstacle we've encountered, but hopefully it'll be the last. As Ms. Ernst and Ms. O'Grady expressed, the community is frustrated with this latest delay, primarily because we weren't really informed as to the reason. And this is an equal partnership between the Friends of the Library and the county, and we hope to be treated as equal partners in this process. There are many county departments involved throughout the years, admin, general services, including real property division, as well as the architectural division, and county council has all worked very hard to bring this project to fruition. And I'm hoping that we can continue with a viable partnership, and that while this obstacle is challenging, hopefully it will be the last obstacle and we can move forward. It was our hope, as both Ms. Ernst and Ms. O'Grady said, that we could open the doors during Atascadero Centennial this year. This latest delay may prevent that. And it is more important to have a quality project and an expeditious project, but I think we can have both. And so going forward, I hope that we can maintain a good, clear line of communication between the community of Atascadero, the Friends of the Library, and the county, and we can have the best possible project. But we also need explanations as to why there are delays, should there be any further delays. Concerns about escalating costs and quality of work based on what we've gotten so far, we were feeling very good about meeting our goals and reaching our goals, and I would just hope that we can continue with a better line of communication, a better line of understanding. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Mike Brown, followed by Lindy Owen.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. On the matter of the library bid, we agree with the speakers, and we think you need to hone in on the exact reason that your appeal panel made its recommendation to rebid it. And you probably ought to ask them directly, because the board letter had no information in it whatsoever. It was just a lot of background on the project. On another matter that's on the consent calendar, item 13, the sale of county-owned parcels in Cayucas. This matter says that the Estero plan requires the protection of view sheds, and that people who are driving on Highway 1 or using the beach should not have to look back at the hills with houses on them. Well, there's already houses on the hills, and if you look at the map in your package, you can see that the place is subdivided and these parcels are scattered throughout. And we think you need an analysis before you decide to do this. If those parcels were actually allowed to develop at some point, and I realize there may be some water questions and things, but going out into the future, and they had houses built on them, you know, they'd be view houses, because if they're a problem for the view up, they must have a view down. So if there are 48 of them and they were built at $750,000 a piece, what would that property tax be for the first year they were all complete, phased in? I realize it might take time. And what would they be, you know, 5 years out, 10 years out, 25 years out, accumulatively? Are you throwing away millions, tens of millions of dollars in potential property taxes in the name of an ideology that somebody driving 50 miles an hour on Highway 1 can't see a house out of the corner of their eye?
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Lindy Owen, and that's my last request to speak on consent.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos, and I'm speaking on item 18, which is a request to approve a budget 2013-2014 renewal employment contract with James Vogue in the amount of $137,280 annually, and basically annually, to get a 21% increase to $137,280 annually. That's a $24,336 increase. We are in times of budget shortages everywhere, and no shortage in the Sheriff's Department, especially with what happened yesterday. I would urge that Commander Vogue rescind the request for this raise and let the money be put to work covering some of the shortages and the areas that we need in the future for law enforcement and safety and protection to the people. I just see this is not a time for people to have large salary increases, and I would urge that he donate that $24,000 as a donation to the betterment of the Sheriff's Department and activities they can do to help provide the services they do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Having no further requests to speak, I'll close public comment at this time and bring it back to the board for questions or comments. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a brief comment on 12 and then questions on 18 and 19.
Okay. Mr. Hill.
Comments on 2 and 5, sir.
Okay. Ms. Arnold.
For me it'll be 2. And since I see Julie Rodewald here, I'd like to chat about item number 11, please.
Okay. Mr. Meacham.
Might as well pull the whole thing. 2, 10, 18, and 19.
10, 18, 19. Okay, we'll start with Mr. Meacham on item number 2.
Well, I'd like to have staff, Ms. Pell, if she could come up and answer the questions that the folks have raised here. I think they raised some very relevant points.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm Jeanette Pell, General Services Agency Director. And I first want to acknowledge that I'm very aware that the Friends of the Atascadero Library are disappointed, as our staff. We are very disappointed as well that the bids, that we're requesting that the bids be rejected. When bidders bid in San Luis Obispo County, they have a right to protest. And that's what happened in this particular case. There was an informal protest and then a formal protest. And during the formal protest, we heard from both the lowest bidder and the second lowest bidder. And basically, they both presented valid points. They were reasonable arguments. And the protest board really had a difficult time drawing a conclusive answer, or it was still ambiguous as to both sides what they were presenting. So we thought it was in the best interest of the project to reject all bids and rebid, because we want to make sure this project gets done. We don't want it delayed any further.
Can you be more specific in terms of what the protest was so that these folks understand why this has been delayed?
So it gets somewhat complicated, but I'll do my best. So this particular project requested that some certified steel work be done by a subcontractor. The lowest bidder number, or the second lowest bidder, identified a steel subcontractor. The lowest bidder did not. But the lowest bidder believed that he could perform the work with a substitute. And so both sides actually had a pretty again, it wasn't clear cut as to if they could, the first lowest bidder could actually perform the work. But we had responded to a request and a question and an augmentation where the question was asked, could we substitute the certification with something from the Los Angeles School District? The county's answer was ambiguous in the fact that we didn't really answer the question. and we felt that the lowest bidder may have misinterpreted that, and so we thought it was just in order to avoid potentially additional protests that we would recommend that you reject all bids and rebid the project.
The low bidder, I guess it has to do with a certified steel, if I understand this correctly. They would. This seemed to be a minor issue because they could provide that at any point. Was that specifically required in the bid document?
It was our the hearing protest board. It wasn't clear if they could provide it at any time. It's my understanding when you bid a project that you need to identify all your subcontractors, and the lowest bidder did not.
This is the PAP, the appeals board. I was not part of that, but in the best interest of trying to get moving with this project, they made their decision. The decision's been made now to go ahead and reopen the bids, and I want to respond to Mr. Patterson and Ms. O'Grady and Ms. Ernst. We are taking it so seriously, and I'm not one to say we can't get this done in this coming year. Providing there are no more glitches, the construction, it's my understanding that the bids will open again by, or excuse me, conclude, and the construction can start just right after May 16th, tomorrow. Tomorrow we all have a meeting together, and Ms. Pell and I will both start joining you in your meetings with county administration so that we can do everything we can to expedite the construction phase and try to get this done. And like I say, I'm not ready to give up and throw in the towel. Just try to work towards that original goal of getting this open in the centennial year for Atascadero. The second bidder and the first bidder obviously both thought that they had just cause to protest and maybe go even further, and going further would cause more delays to getting this started. So in this case, I think we're all just trying to do the best we can to get it all moving and try to make up for lost time.
Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I echo Supervisor Arnold's sentiments. And Supervisor Patterson knows probably better than anyone how the county has been a partner on this. And so just on behalf of the Board of Supervisors and the county, I understand the disappointment that the citizens of Atascadero feel about this delay. And I apologize on our behalf. And I think that I will be happy to help Supervisor Arnold as things move forward to make sure that not only the Friends of the Library are fully informed as the process moves forward, but that anything and everything can be done to make this happen in this important anniversary year for Atascadero.
Thank you. And I reflect the comments of my colleagues, and I am quite disappointed that it's come to this, and I'm not happy about it amongst other things that are going on. But we will work through and do the best we can. And as Supervisor Hill said, we will do our best to accommodate the people in the community of Atascadero, and we thank you for being here this morning. Okay, moving on. Item number five, Supervisor Hill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just our contract with the folks who are putting on the Amgen finish that's occurring next month in Avila. And I wanted to thank, you know, we've had a really good county. This came to us kind of suddenly, and Mr. Buckshy and I had to scramble to put everybody around the table and make sure that that we could pull this off. And Mr. Schulte, has our assistant CAO, deserves a lot of credit for negotiating on behalf of not just the county's interests, but all the community's interests, so that our costs are met. And that we can have this event that will be a hopefully not only fun, but it'll be safe. And we've had the both our sheriff and our fire chief were here, very involved. We've got the highway patrol. We expect it will be a very very fun event for Avila on May 16th. But I just wanted to thank Mr. Schulte and also thank my legislative assistant, Hannah Miller, who's done a lot of legwork for me on making this happen as well.
Thank you. Supervisor Meacham, item number 10.
Just a quick comment, if I could. This is a resolution that was recognizing Colonel Barbara Newsomer for her service as garrison commander at Camp Roberts in the California National Guard. Last Saturday, my legislative assistant, Vicki Shelby, attended that. I attended a luncheon with Supervisor Teixeira with the honor flight gentlemen that were heading back to the World War II Memorial. But Barbara has, the Colonel has been amazing in terms of her outreach and working with us in the JLUS or the Joint Land Use Study with Camp Roberts and the surrounding area. She will be retiring. She has had quite a distinguished career, and so they had a change of command, but she's going to be there for a little while. So I just wanted to let folks know how appreciative we are of working with the Colonel and working with the base.
Thank you, Supervisor Meacham. Supervisor Arnold, item number 11.
Yep. Ms. Rodewald's here to explain. And the reason I had asked to just learn a little bit more about this is about destroying the audio on various county proceedings. And so my question, and Julie and I actually spoke yesterday, so my question was about, and we all saw in our staff reports, it's a laundry list of things. Some more important than others, but for me, just wondering about the capabilities or the advantage to us as a county of keeping a little longer our audios of possibly assist
software that we no longer use. We've tried to access those files with other than other. It's a WAV file, but it comes up in the software. It has timestamps so that it's easy to find items. So the concern is maintaining it with an expectation that it's usable. We used to keep our audio recording on reel-to-reel tapes. We used to keep it on cassette tapes. Those only last for a certain amount of time. I was explaining to Supervisor Arnold yesterday that we do maintain all of the board records, the minutes, the staff reports, the final documents in perpetuity. And that means not only are they accessible in our office on microfilm or on paper, but they're also, if they're on microfilm, that original microfilm is stored offsite in a vault that can withstand a nuclear blast. So even if we're not here, those records will be maintained for someone. But I just want to be clear that we don't want to raise the expectation that by keeping the audio, it means that it's going to be usable, because we don't retain, since we're not required to maintain it in perpetuity, we don't maintain it in multiple copies, we don't maintain it in the secure vault. So I don't want there to be an expectation just because we have it that means that it's always going to be accessible. So, but it's up to, you know, it was a board policy that we changed it to 5 years. I can bring that back. We can pull those items off of the list of destruction for today. It's up to your board.
And I pulled it and asked for the explanation. Thank you, Julie. Just so we can discuss it, if we thought there was, in the interest of transparency in government, an advantage or a benefit to the citizens here in the county to keep that audio available a little longer than 5 years. I just wanted to hear from my colleagues. They had any thoughts?
I think if we're keeping it longer than we're required and we've got a form of it on file, I think we're fulfilling the need.
I tend to agree. I mean, if we're exceeding what's required of us, and I don't see – I hate being on TV to begin with, but
maybe Ms. Rodewald could cut a highlight reel out of each meeting. You know, do on ESPN.
The greatest hits.
Greatest hits
compilation.
Greatest
hits.
In my case, when you have a face for radio, it's very difficult to be on TV, Mr. Meacham. So.
Okay. I had some constituents ask, and I appreciate the discussion being held in public forum. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rodewald.
Thank you.
Okay, Supervisor Gibson, item number 12.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had a comment about the sale of surplus property in Cayucas, which is, in fact, item 12. This issue, as the staff report goes into, has been an issue in Cayucas. It's an antiquated subdivision on a hillside. And at this point, the parcels that are under consideration, given the zoning, are too small to support the construction of single-family residence. It's a true antiquated subdivision. And staff report goes into all the details of why they will not be able to support single-family residences. So the work with various conservation organizations has been very helpful in resolving this particular issue.
Okay.
Just wanted colleagues to be aware.
Thank you very much. Item number 18, I've got Supervisor Meacham and Supervisor Gibson.
Yeah. I'd like to call the sheriff up if we could. And first of all, I want to preface my comments by I think that that your office has been, how do I put this nicely, been so much more efficiently run since you've taken office. I think that you have raised the bar considerably, and I greatly appreciate what you've done. I just think that it's important that the public understands why this request has been made and what we gain from this. If this means even more efficiency than you've provided, then I can support this. But I need to get a little bit clearer explanation.
Thank you. Ian Parkinson, Sheriff Corner. First, thanks for the opportunity to come up here and speak with you. These are important decisions that I'm sure that you consider carefully. I wanted to point out that I do not consider this an attack personally on Mr. Vogue, nor does he. He certainly understands that this is a business decision. That's the way we should treat these things, and they certainly should be justified and at least explained for you to have all the facts. So I wanted to take a second and just kind of discuss the facts with you and give you a little bit of foundation for making your decision on whether or not you're going to support this. First, a little bit of history. Over the 7-year pain plan, the sheriff's office has lost 25 positions, one commander, two sergeants, 9 sheriff's deputies, and 6 correctional deputies. This is important. These are fundamental services that we have to provide, both in custody, in the care and custody of the inmates, but also any impact on the general fund as well. And so, again, this clearly demonstrates that, you know, I have a desire to get more patrol coverage out there, better response times, and I certainly understand that we have to remain fiscally responsible in the process of doing that. And I think just, you know, returning $3.2 million in 2 years demonstrates clearly that we got our eye on that as well. One of the major concerns when I was campaigning, and certainly my first year of office, was internal affairs, and it was, are we policing our own? Are we doing a good job with that? And we felt that we needed to improve that, and certainly the public felt we needed to improve that. And so for me, I looked internally at what we could do internally, and with those cuts that we took, those positions that we lost, we truly didn't have a position to pull from in order to fulfill a public desire and an internal desire from members of my department. Without impacting further our response and patrol, it would be pulling somebody from the street more than likely and compromising that service. So I was fortunate enough to find Jim Vogue, who had in fact retired and come up here with 33 years experience in running Los Angeles Police Department Internal Affairs, which was actually larger than my entire department, which is a little scary. Because I did not know the extent of what we needed to do internally, we brought Commander Vogue in as a temporary employee at step one without any benefits. But what we quickly realized is that the problem was a little larger than we thought, that there were other areas that we needed to address, certainly other than just complaints, and that evolved around use of force. Pursuits, audits, just to name a few, and audits such as the property room audit and things such as that. And in addition, Commander Vogue has also provided countywide training, not only just for our people, but for every law enforcement agency in this county. So I mentioned at the very beginning that I know that your focus is not on Commander Vogue, the person, and more the cost, I do need to point out the fact that he's a very rare find for us and a very big benefit to this county, and it's a person that I personally can't afford to lose. And trust me, there's people that have knocked on his door many a time to try to pull him away. So the level of experience that he brings is phenomenal. Now, bringing him in at step one over the past couple years, I need to explain that real briefly, that step typically, when you bring in an employee, we evaluate their level of experience to bring him in at one, which step to bring him in at. With Jim's amount of experience, I would have brought him in at step three. But because it was the unknown, we brought him in at step one, not really realizing the total scope. So we brought him in at step three, and it had been the normal process through that every county employee receives as far as salary increases, he would have been at step five now anyways. But just that savings of having him at step one over the last 2 years, we saved just on the salary alone $43,000, bringing him in at step three. In addition, without benefits over the last 2 years, that amounts to about $125,000. So it's significant savings, and to me, it's a pretty darn good deal that we have made for the county and for us. I don't think about this as a pay raise personally. I think it as equal pay for equal job. Jim's job as a commander, he's got a lot of responsibility. We put a lot of responsibility on our commanders. They're working as basically chiefs of the substations. Jim's responsibility is equal to that. He's not receiving equal pay for that. I think it's fair that we give him equal pay for equal duties, and this is really where that comes from. And I'll just point out that we're going to continue to save with him in that position because we're still not going to be paying his benefits. And so I certainly respect that this is of concern, and you're absolutely right to bring it up and ask me those questions, and certainly the public has, you know, their right to ask that. But I really do feel that it's appropriate. It's still a great deal for the county, a great deal for the citizens, and really it's just bringing them up to a standard that we really need to have them at for the equal duty and job.
If I could follow up just briefly, at some point he's going to retire, and so you won't be able to keep
him. He's never going to retire.
When that happens, I mean, obviously, is this going to be a position that you're going to continue to try to fill?
Yes, it would be my intent to try to get it into our PALs to have the position for a variety of reasons. One, exactly that. He is going to retire and against my wishes. And we're going to have to mentor somebody into that position. And that's part of Jim's duties in his training aspect, is get somebody in that position to where they're...
That all is absolutely appropriate. Further, let me stipulate that you have been fiscally responsible. I'm impressed with the way you run your office, and I know that you're working constantly for better efficiency in the job that you do. You have lost position. Your department has lost positions, as has virtually every department in this organization that's of any size. So, with that as a background, my question is: you speak about bringing Mr. Vogue on as a temporary employee, but it's my understanding we're looking at a contract here, so he's not a county employee at this point, is he?
Well, yes, it is a contract. We brought him on as a temp employee, and then last year we actually made it into a contract because we're trying to move away from a long-term temporary employee.
Okay, but what we're dealing with here is a contract negotiation. And we're looking at a 20% raise in the contract price for the services that are going to be rendered. I mean, the argument of these step things is appropriate if we're talking about employees, but this is a contract. We have a job to do, and you have led a contract with an individual who's doing, by all accounts, a good job. And so really what we're talking about is a negotiation between the county and that individual for continuing to do that job. Isn't that more the way to look at this?
No, that's definitely a way to look at it. That's not the way I look at it, but I think you're accurate in the way you're looking at it. I just look at it as he is an employee, and it is done. His compensation is done through contract rather than a position.
He actually functions. He presumably wears the uniform or not of the department. I don't know. Not germane at this point. But if we take your argument of steps as being the way to gauge this work, you brought him in at step one for whatever reasons you would do. 2 years later, as a county employee, he would be at step three, which I would equate to about a 10% raise, which is a raise in pay that no county employee, well, maybe there are a few new employees who have stepped up like that, but the raise over 2 years would be 10%, And I can understand that. I guess what I have a little bit of a problem with is you speak about the job being greater than it is, thought to be when it started. But what this amounts to is that pay for hourly work going up. Now, are the number of hours going up? I mean, if the job is bigger, we need more hours, don't we? Do we need to pay the individual doing that job more money to get it done?
Well, I understand where you're coming from. I don't look at it as it's not an hourly issue. It's a matter of compensating them for equal work for equal job, and that's what this is about. It's not. I didn't look at it as he needs a pay raise. We brought him in below market value, as far as I was concerned, because I took a conservative approach to what the issues were and the need. I think we've certainly learned from that, and now I look at it as is. Had I received a new allocated position, it would cost the county a considerable amount of more money than this is today, even at step five. Mm-hmm. And so, from my view, it's simply that if he's going to perform the duties of commander, and that's the position that he would have been, or the level he would have been had I brought him in as a regular position, then that's fair compensation, and it's still a good deal for the county. So that was, I guess, my view of it.
And so would that be the normal rank of an individual heading internal affairs within a sheriff's department? Is a commander the right rank?
Yes, depending on your structure, you have to have it at that level because you're investigating supervisors as well.
Okay. And what would be the, if we had a commander employed, what would be the fully loaded cost of a commander at step, if you happen to have it at step three or at step five? Or
I actually happen to have it. Step four, I have, pardon me?
Can you see it?
Yeah, that's what I'm struggling with there. Here. I had big print on my notes.
Sheriff, you're more than welcome here.
I'm feeling
here to help.
Coming
this
back.
This is a helpful dialogue, I hope.
So at step four, total comp I have is 196. At step five, I have total comp of 201.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your being here to discuss this. Like I say, I have no question as to the quality of this work. It is a little bit of a bite to chew to see that kind of raise in a contract at times when other county employees are generally not seeing anything above their step increases, which this really amounts to. So at this point, I'll yield the floor to other colleagues.
Got it. This is, for me, this is about all the other skilled folks that work for the county that have had no raise or taken pay cuts in the last couple years that probably could take their skills and go to another county and receive a higher wage, yet they stay and kind of work this out. So for me, this is a real struggle to look the rest of the employees in the eye and say, certain people, you're all worth it, but a few people are going to get such an excessive raise. It's really difficult for me, and it's all about that.
The only point I'd offer on that is that a new employee coming in here has built-in pay raises. This is what it's about. It's within the pay scale. This is not somebody that's at step five that I'm trying to go beyond their normal pay scale. So if they're a normal employee and I start here, let's state even at step one, I go through the progressions of pay raises. That's what you promised me as an employee. So that's the scale that we're following. I'm not asking in addition or above what a normal employee would be entitled to. That's the scale that I'm trying to follow. So if I came in here and he was at step five for commander and I was asking for additional money, trust me, I would have to agree with you. But in this case, a regular employee that starts at the county is entitled to those pay steps. Outside of regular negotiated increases, it's something that they receive. And so that's what I'm asking the mirror, is that give him the same consideration that any other employee of my office or within the county receives, and give them the opportunity to receive that increase. Because he's worked without it, and he works without benefits. And I think this is an opportunity. And certainly you could reflect on his prior employment, but the fact is it's a benefit that he's providing to the county, and I think he should receive the same right to step increases as any other employee, and that's really what it's about.
Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I share the sentiments of my colleagues about the context of this not being ideal, I'm prepared to give deference to the sheriff on this matter. As he alluded to, this was a major issue that we, in fact, myself and the sheriff, before he was sheriff, talked about when he was a candidate for sheriff, the need for a revitalized internal affairs and the need for this to be something that not only is important and credible to the department, but to the public as well. We, as you know, are privy to a certain amount of information in terms of what happens or does not happen. I'm pleased that we're not having to spend a lot of time, for instance, in closed session on things that are not or are happening or handled well internally. And so with that, I would, if my colleagues want to pull it for a separate motion, I'm understanding of that, but I will give deference to the sheriff on this item.
Supervisor Meacham.
Just want to follow up quickly. Ian, you mentioned that he is not getting benefits, so will that continue as such?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm, as a matter of efficiency, once again, and I think efficiency should be rewarded. I think not efficiency should not be, and it should be taken to task. And in your case, in your department, I think the efficiency level has been rising continuously. If this is going to provide the public with an even more efficient department, then I can support that. So I don't have to pull that for separate motion, but
okay.
I do want to make one quick comment on back on item two. I will not, I'm not going to support denying this and extending this time. I think we should award the contract. It's too minor to deal with.
Okay. Further comments on this item? Supervisor Arnold?
Back on 18.
Okay.
Back on 18.
Yep, 18.
If it's not going to, I'm not going to pull this. And what I'm really struggling with is the fact that, I mean, this is a contract, but other employees that are just as valuable to the county aren't able to even come forward and our department heads and ask for this kind of increase in the salary. But at this time, when we know that we need to increase our law enforcement presence in the county, and with the sheriff, that I just think we have the best sheriff in the state, maybe the world. Asking and really standing firm on this request, I just hope that other folks understand this is a lot of money. It's a lot of money to go to one single individual when we're cutting other folks. So I'm looking at it more as a vital tool, a vital team, and you're telling us you absolutely need this to happen and to keep the folks here in the county safe, and so I'm going on that.
Thank you. Thank you.
I would only add to what colleagues have said, and the thing that I would say, with a good internal affairs department, you're going to save quadruple that amount of money in a year. If you have one problem, one lawsuit will dry that up.
If an analysis of this lab is going to be undertaken in the coming months, I'm wondering why we should, at this point, mid-year in the budget process, be looking at adding to our position allocation list. I understand that this is a sort of the flip side here. We've got a contract expiring. But I would feel more comfortable, I think, if we were to contract somehow, whether it's a lab that's a little bit slower, although the details of that performance was not listed in the staff report, or whether we put this on as a limited-term position while we work out the business case for the lab. Because once we put things on the PAL, removing them from the PAL becomes a much, much larger thing. So I was wondering, for instance, I would feel more comfortable, and I would propose to colleagues that we put this second position on limited term, pending the business case for what the lab is going to do.
Well, let me give you maybe a little bit of information that might change that view. We vetted out all of our options. This is really not a position that falls, you know, as the sheriff's responsibility. It's really a county responsibility through the collection of fines that we provide this throughout the county to the other law enforcement agencies as well. We've been fortunate enough to have a contract for the past 26 years, and it's really been a real benefit to us. Sandy Rakestraw has done an outstanding job for the county, not only on the testing of the evidence, but also in testimony for the DA's office, which is really another critical part of this. As far as the lab goes in this evaluation, Dan Buckshaw and I have discussed this. We're really looking at where's the future of the lab. I think the need is there, and I think we're working on a grant project now that would actually increase even more funding to the county, you know, by using our own lab. I think it's a matter of being on the same page, and maybe Dan wants to speak more about that from his end, but I think we're on the same page as understanding. We need to kind of remap this out, because it was really, quite frankly, open prior to my time. Regards to the limited term position, I just want to end with that, and that is that the challenge with this is a highly qualified, experienced position. They have to have 2 years working in the lab in order to certify our lab. The challenge we have, it's going to be a very difficult recruitment, as is. If we make it a limited term, this is not the time to find somebody to fill that need, and that is the biggest challenge.
And is that consistent with your experience that when you tried to find other contracting labs, you did research to try to find other contracting labs, were unsuccessful? So, I mean, I guess what gives us the sense that we're going to be able to find somebody for this, and what are we going to do in the interim if this is a
Well, we have looked around, and we think there are some candidates out there, and I think we believe we can attract them. Why wouldn't we? We've got a great area to move to. The challenge is if we make it limited term, they're not going to be as attractive, and so it's going to limit our pool. And we do have an alternative plan. We do have an emergency plan if things don't work out in recruitment. It's kind of a stopgap. Because I think District Attorney Shea agrees that it's vitally important that we have the right person in this job, both for the testimony end of it in court and for the lab analysis.
So. I understand those issues. So then maybe Mr. Buckshaw's comment here. I'm curious then, what is the study of the business model then? What are we studying when we go off to study a business model here? If we need this service and we recruit somebody to do it, what else is there to know?
Yeah, we're in a little bit of a rock and a hard place from the standpoint that the company that's been providing this business is going out of business. I believe it's a single woman who's run the operation, and she's retiring here in a few months. And so, you know, the sheriff has been working with our department to look at other options, whether we could bring in somebody temporarily, contract with another organization, another company, or bring in somebody on contract. And it didn't seem at this point that we could land those options in this short period of time, that the best option was to try to recruit somebody for a permanent position. All that being said, from my perspective, this is still potentially an intermittent organizational model that we'd like to take more time over the next few months, this summer, maybe into the fall, depending how long it takes, to look at some of the different options, whether we could do a more comprehensive search to see if there are other vendors that might be able to provide this. There is the DOJ facility in Santa Barbara, Ventura, that initially looks like they may not be able to provide the level of service that that we're accustomed to here to, but we can look at that option a little bit further and just really work this through more, where we're not quite under the time crunch in order to keep this service going in the interim.
So, I mean, in adding to this to the position allocation list, are we doing so with the idea that it's not
okay, Madam Clerk?
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
I'll move approval on item number 2.
Second.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
No.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Teixeira?
No. Okay. Moving on to presentation calendar.
Move to approve the presentation calendar.
Second.
Okay. Roll call vote.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Teixeira?
Yes. Okay, presentations, item number 20, resolution for National Poetry Month. Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the representatives of Arts Obispo would come forward, it's my privilege to read the resolution proclaiming April the National Poetry Month. And people may know that yesterday Sharon Olds won the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry for her book Stag's Leap, which I recommend. So read poetry this month, buy poetry. Let me read the resolution. Whereas the Academy of American Poets established the month of April as National Poetry Month in 1996, and whereas National Poetry Month seeks to highlight the extraordinary legacy and ongoing achievement of American poets, introduce Americans to the pleasures and benefits of reading poetry, bring poets and poetry to the public in immediate and innovative ways, and make poetry an important part of our children's education. And whereas the National Poetry Month, under the leadership and direction of the Academy of American Poets, is now the largest literary celebration in the world, and poetry enhances and enriches the lives of all Americans, including children, which we see up there, students and adults living, studying, and working in San Luis Obispo County. And whereas the creation and study and appreciation of poetry helps build cultural bridges, contributes to cross-cultural understanding, and preserves the traditions and contributions of citizens in San Luis Obispo County, and whereas poetry has produced some of the county's leading creative artists and has inspired other local artists in fields such as music, theater, film, dance, and the visual arts, now therefore be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim April 2013 as National Poetry Month in San Luis Obispo County. And I see my good friend Mary Kay Harrington, the Executive Director of Arts Obispo, so why don't you come up and get our...
I am delighted to be here. Thank you very much for your support. The county has been a great supporter of the arts, county arts organization, the County Arts Council. We call ourselves Arts Obispo. And thank you for that resolution. I feel as if we're going from the sublime to the mundane now, talking about poetry. We all know deep down that poetry circles our life, that it clarifies what we think and feel, and that it beautifies our lives. And I, before I introduce these folks behind me, I just want to, my mind does not work memorizing poetry like it used to, but I've attempted. And there are some wonderful lines by T.S. Eliot that I'm going to quote, and this is from The Wasteland, a very long poem, and he says, April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. That's probably the clearest thing Eliot ever wrote. But it's 1922 that lovely first few lines were published. And I have to think about our California experience is very different from his. But, of course, he came from England. And so April was the cruelest month then. Arts Obispo, the county arts organization, supports a lot of things. And one of the things that we support is the arts and education, and we care very much about language and about clarity and about how all of us benefit from the word made clear. I'd like to introduce, thank you for calling me the executive director, but I am merely the president of the board of Arts Obispo. Charlotte Alexander is the executive director. Jenna Hartzell is our program director, and I'd like to introduce Nathan Shields, who grade school kids who write many, many different things. That award will be, those awards will be given out in May. And we also have something called the Ingrid Reddy Literary Contest. Some of you may remember her. She was a beloved teacher, and her family has given us money to support a literary contest every year. So apart, certainly, from visual arts, we do other things, just to make that clear. And since this is Poetry Month, the Arts Obispo staff and all our volunteers are at a poetry booth every Thursday night at Farmers Market, where people come by and create bits and pieces of their own poetry or a line or two they remember. Alas, that may happen. And we are making banners out of those. And so what I have for you, since I do know that there are some creative writers on the Board of Supervisors. I have heard that. And so what I'd like is for you to also support us by either creating or trying to remember a line or two or five of a poem you love, or you can even look one up. We thank you very much for your support over time.
Thank you very much. Good work to you. Mr. Meacham.
I was kind of hoping to hear from the little guy. I thought maybe he did a poem.
Thank you. Supervisor Arnold.
Yes.
Item number 21.
All right. I have a resolution proclaiming the month of April 2013 as San Luis Obispo County Crime Victims' Rights Month.
Good morning.
Good morning. Whereas thousands of San Luis Obispo County residents and visitors are directly harmed by crime each year, and each crime affects many more family members, friends, neighborhoods, and coworkers, and whereas since 1977, crime victims in San Luis Obispo County have benefited from local government and community-based victim service agencies that work to protect and promote the rights of crime victims and provide a host of crisis and support services to help victims rebuild their lives after crime. And whereas the District Attorney's Victim Witness Assistance Center serves all types of crime victims and works in partnership with the Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo, the newly merged North County Women's Shelter and Resource Center, and SARP Center, and the county social services and probation departments. And whereas San Luis Obispo County joins the state in recognizing Crime Victims Rights Month, and by this action seizes an opportunity to celebrate the energy, creativity, and commitment that launched the victims' rights movement, inspired its progress, and continues to advance the cause of justice for all victims. Now therefore be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors that the county proclaims the month of April is San Luis Obispo County Crime Victims Rights Month, thereby reaffirming our commitment to meet challenges and create opportunities to enforce victims' rights and acknowledge those victims and survivors who've transformed their personal tragedy into a motivating force to improve our response to crime victims and build a more just community.
You don't want to be in the milk carton?
No.
Okay.
Okay, great. Good morning, Jerry Shea, District Attorney. Thank you very much for this resolution proclaiming this month as Victims' Rights Month in the County of San Luis Obispo. As you probably know, one of the main and primary duties of the District Attorney's Office, besides holding criminals accountable, is to support crime victims as they journey through the criminal courts in trying to seek justice. And, you know, justice is kind of a funny word. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But to crime victims, we've found that it means several things in common. One is that they would certainly like their physical or emotional needs and hurts and wounds healed in some way by the system. They would, if they've lost some property, have that property restored if they could. Certainly they want perpetrators held accountable, but they also want to be part of that process that holds them accountable. And probably even more than those, they want their communities to stand by them respectfully as they go through this criminal justice system, many of the victims not wanting to be a part of the criminal justice system in the first place, but there they are. So I just want to thank you for the proclamation. And, you know, those things that we just talked about in terms of standing beside crime victims as they go through the process and helping them through all these different needs that they have is precisely what the Victim Witness Division of our office does on a daily basis, countless times. Division, who'd like to say a few words to you?
Thank you. Cindy Marie Absey, Victim Witness Director for the DA's office. So very proud to be here again this year for recognition of Crime Victims Rights Week. It is the one time a year that we come before you to acknowledge and recognize the importance of crime victims' rights. It's something that I've spent my life devoted to, as have many of my staff members and our colleagues in the nonprofit sector. It occurred to me as I was listening earlier today, Supervisor Teixeira mentioned the Boston Marathon bombings, and as we watch events unfold there and learn more about that event, it may be worth noting that there are crime victim advocates working with those victims and families as we speak, providing a variety of crisis and support services to help them make a very horrific situation just a bit more bearable. It doesn't take away from the terribleness of the crime and the event, but there is help available sometimes behind the scenes, and that's what victim advocates often bring. I do want to also take this opportunity to thank the board for your recent addition of a half-time position to the Victim Witness Assistance Unit, of an advocate to work with victims affected by the realignment changes to the criminal justice system. That was new legislation, of course, that we've all been dealing with, and crime victims were not really considered in that legislation, but I'm proud to say that in our county, we've been at that table, and it is a concern of all the community corrections partnership. So our new advocate is on board now, and she's working to get up to speed on helping the victims of those felony offenders that stay local or that return from the state prison system and reside in our community. And Marlene Carter is here with us today. Marlene? So thank you again. That's been a real challenge, trying to weave crime victims' rights into that very complex change to the criminal justice system. With that, I'll turn things back to District Attorney Shea, who has a special guest to introduce to you.
Thank you, Marie. One last thing, if I may. Towards the end of the resolution that Supervisor Arnold read, there were some words to the effect that there are victims, crime victims, who are survivors who have transformed their personal tragedy into a motivating force. And one such survivor was a child abuse victim in a case which we handled towards the end of 2011. In that case, it was a very high-profile case. The defendant was convicted and sent to state prison. And the victim in that case was placed with a foster care family. The victim's foster care mother, Marla Holt, is here today to tell you kind of the rest of the story, if you will. Marla, if you could come up.
My name is Marla Holt, and I was a foster parent. I'm no longer a foster parent because I have adopted Danielle. Nervous. Danielle actually came to me at the end of October of 2010, and she was a very high-profile case, so victim witness was immediately on my phone helping me out. Diana specifically was our contact person, and she would do things as minor as calling me to let me know it had been on the news, because we had to really guard our home. What I really want to praise the Victim Witness Program for was how child-friendly it was. Our first meeting with Victim Witness was at a yogurt shop, where she could just be a kid, and they could get to know her and who she was as a child. We met with the assistant DA, Fabiana. I think that's her title, sorry. I know everybody by their first name because it's a very child-friendly program. We met at the park. We met at the pet store. They really got to know who she was as a child and not as a victim of crime. And then as we went on, we had two goals. the very first goal was to not have to go to court, to not put this 11-year-old in a courtroom in front of her father to testify. And they took that to heart, and they did it. They absolutely achieved it. In the meantime, they had to get her ready to be successful in court in case she had to go. We met at juvenile court. She got to sing on the microphone. She loves to sing. They just made her comfortable in the courtroom, and we ended up not having to go to that courtroom. She came to the courthouse across the street, got to play in that courtroom and sit up on the stand and, you know, talk to the sheriff deputy that was there and made her comfortable. But again, she didn't have to testify, which was wonderful. And I owe all of that to Diana and Fabiana. They were fabulous. The end of the story, Danielle was legally adopted by myself on March 8th of this year.
Typically, I would say almost always get the first call. They're the ones that when we have a disaster of some sort, they're going to get this 911 call. They're the one that's going to start dispatching people. So it's my pleasure to read that whereas Congress of the United States has established the second full week of April as National Telecommunicators Week, and a corps of dedicated public safety telecommunicators serve the County of San Luis Obispo. And whereas the County of San Luis Obispo considers the services of the public safety telecommunicators to be vital to the interest of the community, San Luis Obispo sheriff dispatchers answer an average of 2,362 911 calls a month. And county fire dispatchers add an average of 187 911 calls a month. The professional public safety telecommunicator is that vital link between the citizen or victim and the public safety provider who may apprehend a criminal, save or recover their possessions, save their life, or the life of a loved one. And whereas the safety of our law enforcement officers, firefighters, and emergency medical service providers is dependent upon the quality and accuracy of information obtained from citizens who telephone the San Luis Obispo County Sheriff Public Safety Dispatchers, and whereas public safety dispatchers are the single vital link for our law enforcement officers, firefighters, and emergency medical service providers by monitoring their activities by radio, providing them information, and ensuring their safety. And whereas each public safety dispatcher has exhibited compassion, understanding, and professionalism during the performance of their duties during the past year, and now therefore it be resolved in order that the Board of Supervisors does designate the week of April 14th through April 20th, 2013, as San Luis Obispo County National Public Safety Telecommunicators Week, and join in honoring the men and women whose diligence and professionalism keep our county and citizens safe.
You got to ask the fox about that.
Ian Parkinson, Sheriff Coroner.
Rob Lewin, Fire Chief.
This is the Rob and Ian show for a moment. Spending,
Rob, you can have your own if you want to.
Spending almost a week in Maryland at the Fire Training Center. I kind of feel like a fireman, Rob.
It'll serve you well.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to honor dispatchers. It's a you know, as we say every year, it's just an amazing job that they do. And Supervisor Meacham mentioned something that kind of resonated with me, and that is that think about how many times you've been on the phone with a family friend, a family member or a friend when they're in need of help, and that you wanted so badly to be there in person to help them, but you couldn't. Dispatcher goes through that every single day that they're working, and it's most of the time tenfold as bad as the problem that you're dealing with. It's a considerable amount of stress that they go through every day in dealing with emergencies, yet we expect them to remain calm and remain focused and provide the services that they or the people on the other end of the phone so desperately need. It is a thankless job in a lot of ways because you're just a voice on the other side of the phone, but it is so vitally important for the citizens out in the community, for the deputies in the field, certainly for the firefighters in the field. They are our link, and we can't say enough about how important they are and how fortunate we are to have such a great group of men and women in our dispatch centers that answer that call every day, walk home with that stress every day, and are able to deal with it and still come in with a smile on their face and do their job. So I appreciate you recognizing them.
I just want to add that we live in a great place, a great country, because 100% of the time when someone needs help, they can no longer take care of the situation themselves, they can dial 911 and people will come to help them. Law enforcement and fire and EMS will come and help them. But that all begins with the receive of the call from the dispatchers who calmly and with great experience, great training, make sure that the right resources and assets are going to that incident to help our good citizens and guests in this county. While our, as the sheriff said, while our law enforcement people in the field and our firefighters in the field get a lot of praise, really, let's that praise should begin with those dispatchers who are under the gun every day. My people, 10,000 times a year, receiving these calls and calmly and always, 100% of the time, doing the right job. So thank you very much for recognizing them.
Thank you, Chief Lewin. You got more?
Yeah.
And Richard Margeson.
Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I guess I will begin by, I know that the reason you didn't meet last week was because some sort of a safety emergency response training or exercise was going on, and I hope that we, the people, can hear about it and hear how it went. So please agendize a report out and lessons learned and whatever. We, the people, obviously, will be with you in any emergency, and so we all ought to be on the same page. I also just want to, again, thank you for recognizing Joe Schwartz while he was alive. We had a beautiful memorial for his life at the Atascadero Lake Pavilion this last Sunday, and we can keep him alive by building community. That's what his whole life was about, and we can keep him alive by doing that. I wanted to remind you that this evening is the gathering relative to hydraulic fracturing at the Grange Hall. Slow Clean Water Action will be hosting Californians Rising Up Against Fracking. And yes, it's one side, but certainly there's a lot to learn. My understanding is it will be sort of two main. The first hour will be mostly what are some of the risks and hazards with the fracking process, and then the second hour will be advocacy of a particular approach to dealing with the threat. I'm not totally sold on that approach. It's rights-based ordinances in a municipal setting, and I don't know that they're tested in court, but I certainly think that it deserves a fair hearing. If it may not be the only way to go, but it certainly there can be a lot learned this evening. Again, it'll be at the Grange Hall on Broad Street starting at 7. And, of course, water is something we need to think about not just as something that'll always be there when we want it, but as something priceless. And in honor of National Poetry Month, I thought I would end with a poem that it starts out seeming to be about water, but it ends up being about paradigm shift, which is what we need when it comes to our relation with the earth. This is by Juan Ramon Jimenez. Our little boat has struck against something way down deep, and nothing happens. Nothing. Silence. Waves. Nothing happens. Or has everything happened, and we are now standing quietly in the new life? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Julie Tacker, followed by Lindy Owen.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker from District 2 in Los Osos. I sympathize with our friends in Atascadero in that We've experienced many disappointments in working with the county. I wanted to point out just a quick irony. When Mr. Gibson was speaking earlier this morning about the sheriff's raise, I actually have looked at some past audiovisual looking for similar arguments when the legislative aides were receiving their raises in 2007 and 2008, and unfortunately, we didn't see that kind of champion. Nor do I guess that we will see any kind of champion in arguing the recent raises given to HDR engineering firm in Los Osos and the Los Osos Wastewater Project. The Los Osos Wastewater Project really needs an update in front of your board. I have asked for that in the past, but it's starting to look like we really need a community workshop to discuss some of the issues that are coming up. And something that I'd like to hear from Mr. Gibson is a report on yesterday's meeting with the Regional Water Quality Control Board and how the project is going to deal with dewatering, how the toxic soup of septic returns, groundwater, and the estuary's brackish seawater is going to be dealt with. We really haven't had an explanation of how that water is going to be dealt with in the 7 to 10 million gallons of it a day. Where is our groundwater management plan? The ISJ has been working away behind closed doors.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Lindy Owen, followed by Ben DeFatta.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from Dusty, Dirty Los Osos. I passed out some handouts that we gave during the process of looking at alternative technology and the concerns about what the costs overruns would be with a gravity sewer versus doing it with directional boring. And it truly is coming to fruition now. We are seeing that the, from what I understand, 10% of the pipes are laid and it's already 50% over cost, overrun. It's just difficult to deal with sand and to make progress in Los Osos when you have utilities that have been unmarked for years. And directional boring would have solved everything. The Chumash burial sites were spoken by Chumash elders that they would prefer that directional boring went through their grave sites and their middens instead of what is currently happening, which is opening them up to the daylight. And I do appreciate Mr. Gibson's concern about the sheriff's, you know, the increase of a 20% raise to somebody in this era of financial difficulties globally throughout the U.S. and definitely in this county. But I'd also like to remind everyone that the legislative assistance under Mr. Gibson's oversight, I believe, were given a 40% increase in raise in salary over a two-year period when they went from being one legislative assistant to five separates. Anyway, so just it's interesting that the concern over the Atascadero library failures with the county planning, believe me, that's why we spent 7 years here and another 12 years at home trying to get a better project. We have major problems. The streets are now completely falling to pieces. They were substandard to begin with, and when you run this tremendously heavy equipment back and forth, for weeks on end, each street is taking like 4 weeks to do one block, and you know that the trucks have to come and go. So every surrounding street now is falling to pieces. They're collapsing completely. So, again, that wouldn't have happened with the system that I presented. There was always talk that the dewatered area, which is where you have high groundwater, and we're going to be sucking water out, possibly pulling seawater into our last drinking area, That could have been avoided with a hybrid system. The county promised that they would be looking at a hybrid system for those areas. I request that you get an update, find out what's not going right, and let's make some corrections before we hit a wall.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Owen.
You.
Ben DeFada, followed by Jeff Edwards.
Good morning, Chairman Teixeira, Board, Sheriff, and Public. Ben DeFada from Los Osos, where the trenches to hell continues on with many we told you so problems that are continuing on big time as we speak. We found an email dated 6/7/12 from Gibson's legislative clerk sending out this email to Gibson Board and others. The title is Secret Groundbreaking Ceremony Without Inviting the Public. She starts out by saying hello to my sewer backer friends. She continues with praises and tells everyone she has great news. We had a secret groundbreaking ceremony on May 29, 2012 at the Midtown site, and the first bid will be awarded June 19, 2012. Wow, so much for transparency. If any of you other supervisors showed up, it was really a well-kept secret. What were you worried about? It was as if you were ashamed to invite the public and the media. But I'm sure you invited all your crony friends. Shame on you. She further states, we do not know the cost of the project. We do know that the cost of the project will be difficult for some members of the community to handle, but we're working on ways to help those in need. What's wrong is that there are not just some, but several thousand homeowners or renters that will be in need. You don't have enough money to save these people. What you can get together in this economy is just a drop in the bucket. A big depression is heading for many property owners, renters in this county when several thousand will not be able to pay their property taxes. On another note, we find that our favorite supervisor has been committing nepotism for 6 years with his legislation aid, while 2,600 other county employees must abide to the HR department rules, and you five in the whole county, probably the whole country, don't have to. All of you sitting there, if you were good guys.
My name is Jeff Edwards. I'm a 35-plus-year county resident. This morning, I wanted to address you regarding the Federal Endangered Species Act, particularly as it relates to the Morro shoulder band snail in Los Osos. Also known as Homenthoglypta walkeriana, the Morro shoulder band snail is currently threatened under the act. Originally, it was established as an endangered species in the mid-1990s. And has since been reduced to the threatened level. The Morro shoulder band snail distribution and frequency in the community of Los Osos has become more well known over the last 15 plus years. And the key point I'd like to make this morning is that they are everywhere. They're ubiquitous. The snails, their distribution, they're largely pretty much anywhere you go in town, you can find them. And this has currently been underscored by the construction of the wastewater project. It's my understanding that there have literally been hundreds of live snails found and relocated, probably hundreds if not thousands of empty shell, and it raises the question, are they even threatened? And, the Endangered Species Act is a good idea in general. It's the implementation that creates the difficulties. And there's become this notion of habitat management and the question of individual species habitat management versus multiple species habitat protection. And Los Osos has embraced the multi-species habitat protection approach in that we have, as a community and help with government, created a green belt of over 350 acres around the periphery of the community. This was intended to be for multiple species. But what's the problem is that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service continues to manage species on an individual basis, and the Morro shoulder band snail situation is just such an example. Currently, there's a community-wide HCP that's underway. It started several years ago and has a long, long way to go. There'll be strings attached, and unfortunately, I'm not sure this is going to be the answer. The kangaroo rat, which is another endangered species, is not even covered under our current community HCP. So I think it's important that maybe what we do now is we really analyze whether the species should be further reduced in its listing status, perhaps delisted entirely. And the snail, I will tell you, has frustrated many public and private projects in the community. The library expansion's been frustrated, and even sidewalks. So I'd ask your staff and your board to really explore this question of delisting.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you.
My final request to speak is Richard Margeson.
Richard Margeson. Last meeting, I talked about the February update for Los Osos and have continued to ask you for meetings here to be held at your board on the Los Osos Wastewater Project to address some of the issues. Mr. Gibson keeps telling me staff doesn't have time to have meetings in Los Osos. I handed you a copy of the email that Ben DeFada was talking about that Sherry sent out after having Mr. Gibson review it. I apologize. There are meetings going on in Los Osos. Secret meetings. I'm going to read the email. Hello to my sewer backer friends. I want to say how much it meant to me and staff to read the letter to the editor on May 27, 2012. We have worked very hard to get to this point, and to know there are folks out there that appreciate the work is wonderful. I know it is hard to participate in the public process, especially with the continued negativity. However, I am hopeful that someday the people of Los Osos will return to their community meetings. As far as the project is concerned, we have exciting news. We had a secret groundbreaking on May 29th. Photos attached. The restoration of the Midtown site is underway, and the first bid of the collection system will be awarded on June 19th. We do know that the cost of this project will be difficult for some members of the community to handle, but we are working on ways to help those that will be in need. It truly has been a journey, and we are not done yet. You have my sincere gratitude, Sherry Espiro. This is what we get in Los Osos. Secret groundbreaking ceremonies. Photos attached. I haven't seen the photos. I think somebody needs to make a public records request and find out who's in those photos. Who's in those photos? Moving Forward Save the Dream participants? Nobody from Move the Sewer was invited. And the reason this project is out of town is because of Move the Sewer.
Make sure that it were clear that it was my words and not those of my legislative assistant. But what I wanted to bring to you today, and I would appreciate, Mr. Chairman, if we could have the background noise in the audience reduced.
Is it quiet back there?
I received a foreword of a video that was shot by a resident of Los Osos that I think this board will enjoy. This is Mr. Jeff Lewis, who lives in an area of town and had a time-lapse camera set up when they came to install the main line down his street. And so with the help of the clerk and AGP, Hope, if you could roll this, it's a little over 3.5 minutes, and just watch how it's done. This Mr. Lewis couldn't be with us today. He had a conflicting engagement, but I do appreciate very much him putting this together. It's up on YouTube under the heading Los Osos Sewer Time Lapse. And the interesting thing, and this is a relatively uncomplicated part of town with wide streets and well-defined utilities, the crews in this part of town are laying 200 to 300 feet of main pipe a day, with as much as 400 feet having gone into the ground in one day. But I was struck by this, thought you might be interested. That's what's going on. Clearly, a lot of impact. It's a certain amount of chaos there when a project this big comes to town. But you did notice Mr. Lewis's comments. We're hearing very good feedback on the
unanticipated. Yeah. Is it going well? Is it not?
Yeah.
I appreciate Supervisor Gibson did take me out and show me the area and what was anticipated. Yeah. But I'd be interested for one to hear. Is it going?
Yeah.
Well, are there?
It's by and large going very well. We've had a number of issues that have popped up. You've read in the paper about a known archaeological site that the crews were doing some very careful hand excavation, and they're in the process now of trying to understand exactly how best to treat this this particular site in the community. We have an excellent construction management team that is riding herd on the contractors to hold them to the specs of dust control and traffic control. And that's an ongoing process as they strive for production. We know their impacts, but we have folks making sure that they're holding, and it's going to be an ongoing process. At this point, we have processed no change orders on the project. The construction is going as it has been planned. We will be getting some contract amendments coming. I'm not sure exactly, but I think in the next 30 to 60 days, staff is expecting to bring a number of contracts that will need amending before too long. And at that point, we will put together. I know staff is interested in putting together an update on the project. So I would expect in the next 30 to 60 days, we would likely have something. But
a presentation similar to what we've been seeing on the project.
Yeah, we do have monthly reports. They are posted to the website, and I think the project team will be sending them to supervisors and interested parties. Every month, we try to get out on issues. We've had the February one, so the March one is due fairly soon. We try to, our target I've worked with staff is to have these, 8, 10, 12 page reports, update reports out by the middle of the month following. So the end of March will be sometime fairly soon, I hope. That will be an ongoing process. But a formal presentation here will likely come when we have some action items that need to be, a package of action items that we need to do. So
I'll
we'll be looking forward to it.
Mr. Meacham?
Yeah, and I'm sure that the folks in Los Osos would probably like to see this project done as fast as that film is going. But it would be good to have an update. I know that we just did an update on Highway 46 with my advisory councils, so that they can see exactly what's projected and how things are going to be moving along. That's kind of been a mystery to a number of folks. So I think that would be a good idea to get a good update. And I know that we have some things coming, but for our information, for the public's information as well, it would probably be a good idea.
Sure. We'll work with the project team on getting that together.
Got it. Thank you. Moving on. Any further comments or questions? Madam Clerk, the next item, please.
Item number 24, a hearing to consider an appeal by Core Family Properties of the Director of Planning and Buildings' determination to deny the issuance of two unconditional certificates of compliance, C09-0096, SUB2008-00071, for two parcels, approximately 8.58 acres and 8,600 square feet, within residential multifamily land use category, located adjacent to and south of the intersection of Ramona Avenue and 4th Street in the community of Los Osos, District 2.
Thank you.
Ms. Griffith or Ms. Carroll, who's leading the charge down there?
I guess I will. And, yes, it's still morning, members of the board. This is an appeal of a decision of the director on a certificate of compliance. And Jo Manson is the project manager, and she'll be making the presentation today and walk you through the process.
Thank you and welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Jo Manson, County Planning. An appeal has been filed by Core Family Properties of the planning director's determination to deny the issuance of two unconditional certificates of compliance for two parcels of approximately 8.58 acres and 8,600 square feet each, as requested by the appellant concerning application for certificates of compliance C09-0096. A property owner may request that the county make a determination whether a parcel was legally created or not through the certificate of compliance application process. Certificates of compliance and conditional certificates of compliance are addressed in Section 2102020 of the County Code and are issued under the provisions of the State Subdivision Map Act. The purpose of a certificate of compliance is to provide landowners with a record of the county's determination that a parcel was legally created. If the county residential multifamily land use category, and this is an aerial image of the project site. The application requested legal parcel recognition and one unconditional certificate of compliance for lots 38 and 39, and I'd like to point out that the properties are actually located here, but there is a detailed blow-up, and you can actually see the configuration lot 38, lot 39, and a portion of lot 1 of the map of the town of Sunshine Beach, which was recorded in 1893 and is APN 74229005 and is highlighted in red on this slide. In addition, the application requested legal parcel recognition and one unconditional certificate of compliance for a portion of Lot B of a plat of part of Lot 79 of the Rancho Canada de los Osos, the map of which was filed for record in 1880 and is APN 74229004 and is highlighted in blue on this slide. If each of the proposed parcels had been deeded out and separated from the surrounding lands, those deeds could then provide the evidence of separate legal parcels if the deeds were dated prior to 1960 for parcels less than 3 acres in size and dated prior to 1966 for parcels that are less than 40 acres in size. The appellant has failed to submit evidence of conveyances for each of the proposed parcels separating them from surrounding lands to effectuate their creation prior to either 1960 or 1966 as requested by planning staff. After evaluation of the map information, deed history, chain of title submitted in the application, and consideration of relevant court case determinations, planning staff concluded that the filing of the map of the town of Sunshine Beach did not create separate legal lots, and the deed history did not support the two underlying legal parcels that were requested by the appellant. Planning staff concluded that the deed history for the entire property appears to confirm two legal parcels created by deed conveyance, one for lot 38 and one for lot 39, which are outlined in shades of green on this slide. Excuse me. Each of those lots, lot 38 and 39, are eligible to be issued an unconditional certificate of compliance, one for each small parcel. In addition, the deed history for the entire property confirms that there are also two illegal parcels. Based on deed history, all of lot 1, and I'd like to just point out, you can see the configuration historically of what all of lot 1 was. It was a legal parcel per a pre-1960 deed that was recorded in 1957. However, in 1974, the conveyance of a portion of lot 1 illegally subdivided the lot, because a map was required to be approved to create said parcels in 1974. Regarding the portion of Lot B highlighted in orange, which is the 8.58 approximate acre parcel, excuse me, A pre-1966 deed separating the parcel from surrounding lands would be required to confirm it as a separate legal parcel. The first time the parcel was deeded out separately was in 1998. This conveyance resulted in an illegal subdivision because a map was required to be approved at this time. The appellant contends that the 8.58-acre parcel, as you just saw outlined or highlighted in orange, was created by the 1957 grant of a 40-foot strip of land to the county for Ramona Avenue and is exempt from compliance with modern laws by government code sections relating to the conclusive presumption of legal creation and the exemption from enforceability against transfer. The county accepted the conveyance of a right-of-way easement for the construction and maintenance thereon of a public highway, not a fee interest, cutting the property into two pieces. The appellant makes reference to an attorney general's opinion in his argument. It is staff's and county council's conclusion that the attorney general's opinion is not applicable in this case and is discussed in detail in the staff report. Regarding the applicability of conclusive presumption of legal creation, because the property was not legally created prior to 1972 by board acceptance of the right-of-way deed, the presumption of this government code section does not apply. Regarding the applicability of the exemption from enforceability against transfer, this section does not apply because the property was never legally created by deed conveyance, separating it from surrounding lands, and therefore does not fall within the exemption. The appellant has stated that Ramona Avenue is not a public street which has merely been dedicated to the public as a right-of-way while still privately owned. The county actually owns a strip of land and would continue to after an abandonment. Staff's response, Ramona Avenue or railroad rights-of-way, end quote. Consequently, it is our opinion that county acceptance of a deed for a road, as in this case, where it was an acceptance of a grant of a right-of-way for a road, a right-of-way easement, does not divide property. As for the case of People versus Pacific Land Research Company, staff have concluded that its provisions have no bearing on this case. The county's acceptance of the right-of-way for Ramona Avenue did not separate the fee ownership in the property and create separate legal parcels. Issue 4, the appellant has noted that there is no law in 1957, local, state, or otherwise, prohibiting the sale and division of such lots at this time. County staff response, the appellant incorrectly interprets the 1957 grant deed as a subdivision of property when, in fact, it was not a conveyance of a fee interest, but instead was the conveyance of a right-of-way easement or a road that did not subdivide the property. The fifth and last issue, the appellant's noted, and he's referring to the larger 8.58-acre parcel, noted that this is the sole remainder of a previously legally created parcel as the road is owned by the county and the portion across the road is owned by a nature conservancy. This conservancy lot has already acquired a conditional certificate of compliance, so we, i.e. the appellant, is entitled to one sole remainder from a previously exempt lot that retains this exempt status after the grant in 1957 to the county. County staff response, I'd like to point out that a conditional certificate of compliance was issued and recorded in 2008 for the APN across the street, and I'd like to make that APN reference 74-229-009 on the north side of Ramona Avenue. The current owner is the Morro Coast Audubon Society, and they acquired their interest in the property in 2008. The basis for requiring that property owner to obtain a conditional certificate of compliance is the same as for the subject property. The properties were illegally created. Therefore, it is county staff's conclusion, after evaluation of the map information, deed history, and chain of title submitted along with the application, we've concluded that none of the requested certificate of compliance parcels had deeds that separated them from surrounding lands. Therefore, in our letter dated February 15, 2011, to the applicant's agent, which is noted as Attachment 10 in the staff report, planning staff concluded that we are required to deny the application for the issuance of two unconditional certificates of compliance for those proposed parcels as they have never been legally created. Therefore, it is the planning staff's recommendation to your board that you adopt the resolution denying the appeal and upholding the decision of the Director of Planning and Building, denying the issuance of two unconditional certificates of compliance or application certificate of compliance C09-0096, issue B2008-00071, based on the findings listed in Attachment 8. That concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Questions or comments from colleagues?
If I could,
Mr. Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, let me just be sure that I understand the action before us is simply on the question of the two unconditional certificates of compliance that were applied for by the applicant, and not any determination of unconditional certificates of compliance that staff and county council may think are possible in this case.
Yes, you are correct.
Okay. And you speak of illegal parcels. Maybe you could, it sounds like illegal parcels might have to be incarcerated or something. What's the nature of an illegal parcel, and what happens to an illegal parcel?
Okay. As an example, the larger parcel that was highlighted in orange, the property on the north side of Ramona Avenue, both of those pieces together, even though there's a road running through it, those pieces together, was one legal parcel. Unfortunately, the owner of that entire parcel, who also happened to be Core Family Properties, the appellant today, in 1998, they sold off the piece that was north of Ramona Avenue to another a buyer.
Right.
And at that time, in 1998, per not only the State Subdivision Map Act, but all local ordinances that are in effect at the time, that would have required an application for a subdivision, and that was not done. It was only done strictly by deed.
I see.
So at that time, you had one legal parcel. After the deed conveyance, you had two illegal parcels.
Okay. And one of those was subsequently brought into compliance through a conditional certificate of compliance.
That's correct, in 2008.
Okay. So illegal parcels can be redeemed. I worry about recidivism, but there are ways of regularizing an illegal parcel to make it a legal conforming parcel.
That is correct, okay. And those provisions are listed in the State Subdivision Map Act.
Good. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Supervisor Arnold?
Yep. Thank you, Ms. Benson. I had a few their assessments based on their determination of what can happen on the site. That's without an assessor here. I would defer to council.
Jim Morton from County Council. I think when the deed took place that conveyed it, legal or illegal, the assessor still picked up the conveyance and then valued it accordingly.
Like it as if it were a legal lot, and you assess around the neighborhood and come up with
yes.
Interesting. And then I don't even know if you can answer. Thank you. Thank you. I know I've asked a million questions of staff, so I appreciate everyone's patience. This is really interesting to me because I know there are a lot of lots that were established in this county, pre-1893, 1880, et cetera, just as this family. And then the laws change around. The laws change around us, and families that have owned properties for a very long time maybe are unaware of the changes, and suddenly you have these illegal parcels that were once legal. They were legal when you bought them. So I know it's difficult and hard on people. In 2008, the other side of this parcel obtained a certificate of compliance. It was a conditional. They met the conditions. I don't know if the top of our head, were there a lot of conditions, or do you all remember what conditions were placed on that parcel?
I don't totally recollect what the conditions of approval on that particular conditional cert were, but I know that the current owner acquired their interest not long after the conditional certificate compliance was issued and recorded. It's sometimes referred to as the Sweet Springs area.
So it didn't take too long. I mean, it was relative. I guess I was just wondering, are these conditions just unobtainable or difficult or time-consuming or maybe sometimes under today's rules impossible? But I guess it was just a question. And I guess that's all I had for right now. Thank you.
Supervisor Arnold, just to
try and answer your question. I also don't remember what the conditions that were placed on that adjacent conditional certificate were, but the conditions are typically written to be complied with prior to issuance of any permit for development on the site. So a conditional certificate of compliance can sit out there for many years if the person doesn't develop with this set of conditions that have to be met prior to development.
Great. Other questions? Seeing none, we'll go to the appellant.
Thank you, board members. My name is Spence Hinkle. I'm here representing the Core family. I am an expert in title research and legal parcel formation. However, I believe that we are partially here on some misunderstandings. I'm not local to this county, and my communications with the planning department were mostly through emails and telephone calls, and I think somewhere along the way there was a bit of a miscommunication. First of all, I'd like to point out that my clients are not developers. From the beginning, we've never had an interest in certifying all these four parcels, whether legal or illegally created. What we've wanted to do from the beginning is find a mechanism whereby we could merge all four of the parcels into one existing legal parcel. And in many counties I work in, when I go in to apply for a certificate of compliance, they will allow what's called a voluntary merger, which would be done simultaneously with the issuance of the certificate of compliance. So in this case, it would seem to me that it would fit the purposes of the county from the perspective of planning much better if this parcel were certified as one existing legal parcel only eligible for a single building permit. And if it were to be divided in the future for any reason, it would have to go full discretionary review at county planning rather than us being issued two certificates of compliance for the small parcels and two unconditional certificates of compliance and selling it to whoever may buy it, and who knows what they conceivably could do for minor subdivisions and never have any CEQA approval required. So I believe there's a miscommunication in that there's two lots that there's no dispute were legally created. There's one lot that we do not dispute, a little tiny lot that we do not dispute was illegally created. And then there's the one lot that's in dispute. And I could make some very good arguments as to why that lot was legally created and what, in fact, the board resolved to condemn was a strip of land. And I provided a Supreme Court case. But for our purposes, for what we would like to achieve, it's really immaterial whether the parcel was legally or illegally created, because there's two remedies in the Subdivision Map Act for illegally created parcels. Since we are not interested in developing the four parcels separately, we're not interested in obtaining conditional certificates of compliance for them and having to go through some process to make those conditional certificates Map Act and local ordinances. And I have used this very process in other counties many other times. In conclusion, I believe that result would actually be a more favorable result from the standpoint of land planning than the results proposed by the staff proposal, which would be issuance, have us go back and issue us two unconditional and two conditional certificates, essentially four parcels. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, sir. Questions from colleagues?
When you close to the public, I'll start with a couple questions of staff.
Okay.
We can bring Mr. Hinkle back as necessary if we need.
We got any? Is there any public comment? Anybody wishes to speak on this matter other than Mr. Hinkle? Seeing none, we'll close public comment this time and bring it back to the board.
Yeah.
I'll go to staff.
Yeah. I would ask County Council about Mr. Hinkle's suggestion that there's an alternative working through the merger ordinance, and I'm not sure exactly which. I know we have lot merger provisions, but if County Council might opine here.
Jim Horton from County Council's office. We do have a voluntary merger provisions, and it allows the merger of existing legal parcels, not illegal parcels. So the desire to merge all four together would not work under our merger ordinance. However, lots 38 and 39 could be merged into one parcel because they're been found to be legally created by deed.
If if a and the other thought that occurred to me was a lot line adjustment process. If unconditional certs were issued for one of both of 38, 39, can you lot line between legal and illegal parcels, or do you have to make them legal first?
Well, normally we have a conditional cert issued, and then we would lot line adjust all of the parcels. That would involve a coastal development permit through the county and review by the Coastal Commission also.
Okay. So,
but there is an option of taking legal parcels and doing a lot line adjustment so long as you don't create more parcels than currently exist.
And we have seen lot line adjustments which actually retire parcels. I mean, the desire to go from what looks like four parcels, legal or illegal, to one legal parcel. Once they're legalized, the lot line adjustment could take that in the right direction.
The lot line adjustment would reconfigure the parcels
however many parcels
are shown on the result
might be desired. Okay. Understood. I defer to colleagues' questions, and then I have a thought as to where we need to go.
Supervisor Arnold.
It just sounds like what these folks are trying to do, the lot line adjustment wouldn't fit the bill. It would be more the merger. Once each of these parcels became legal, we could use our merge ordinance to merge them into the one big parcel. But we can't find a way to do that until.
In the past, we have issued conditional certs, and when the conditions have been satisfied, we've then processed. And planning could probably provide more information on that, but. The condition satisfying the condition basically legalizes the lot, and then we've considered it in an adjustment before.
Okay. Other questions from colleagues? Mr. Meacham?
Well, it was just kind of a follow-up. I think he presents an interesting case here in terms of usually we hear where somebody wants to split things into more, and we're trying to find a way to help him establish one. I don't know what we need to do to try to help out with this, but I sure hope we can find a way to do it without.
Well, I have a thought. I have a thought here.
It's going to be scary thought, or is it going to be a good thought?
No, it'd be a good, it'd be happy thought, like the sewer video. You know, okay. We get that music going. In terms of conditions, anybody from planning staff? I mean, do we have a general universe of what sorts of conditions would accompany a permit?
We typically would apply conditions that would have applied if a subdivision map would have been applied for.
And so in this case, it's not a subdivision. It's the desired result is a lot merger to one parcel, zoned residential multifamily, presumably then capable of multifamily development under our coastal zone land use ordinance and local coastal program. So many of the conditions on a certificate or a subdivision would be the same sorts of things you'd see when a development came forward, right? It's the development of public infrastructure and roads and things like that. So where I'm wondering whether we go, where we might be able to go is to proceed with both unconditional for the ones that we think are, can be unconditionally certified, and conditionally certified with a minimum number, a light hand on the conditions. In terms of the general concept, I wonder if council could direct us as to whether that might be a path.
Well, let me just point out something. A request for a conditional certificate of compliance or for a lot line adjustment is also a coastal development permit subject to coastal review. Right. An unconditional certificate of compliance is not.
Right.
When you're reviewing conditions for a conditional certificate of compliance, you're supposed to look at the conditions that could have been imposed at the time the applicant acquired his interest in the property if he'd gone through a map. But they're not mandatory. Those are the most you can require, but you have discretion to not require that much. Okay. So there is some authority on the board give some leniency with the conditions.
And so I've got a suggestion, which would be an action on this particular application and direction to staff to work with the applicant. And I didn't know, Mr. Hinkle, if you had any thoughts based on the discussion you've just heard You know, I think what we'd like to do is get you where your client is interested in going. But as with a lot of things in land use, there's steps and process, as you well know. But any observations you might have through the chair, if that's permissible.
Yes, thank you. I would like to make a couple of comments. First of all, in this particular case, if we are granted a conditional certificate of compliance along, and let's forget the little tiny parcel, just as far as the large parcel and the two legal parcels, if we were granted a conditional certificate of compliance, there's many times when you can be left in limbo because a lot of times you won't be able to meet those conditions. And upon my last evaluation, and it has been a couple years since I've been down here, but upon my last evaluation, it seemed that there was a problem because the parcel would not have met the minimum zoning size. It was either too big or too small for subdivision at the time. And if that condition was placed upon the parcel, well, that parcel would never meet that condition, and we would be simply left in limbo. And then we'd get into other issues of compensation, et cetera. But in the case, I think the bigger factor here is this, to be considered for policy reasons. Because if we have to go the route of going and getting the two unconditional certificates and a conditional certificate, another, and then also going through review of the Coastal Commission, I have a lot of experience dealing with the Coastal Commission. And this is exactly what we wanted to avoid. We wanted to streamline this process so that the county could essentially get the best scenario that they could get from a land planning perspective, which is, let's just have one parcel and have it all subject to review if it's ever to be developed from any point in the future, and my clients could get what they wanted for their perspective in that they just have clear title to a single lot that they could sell to somebody. Because if we don't have that, we're likely going to be selling to, you know, likely a developer. And that developer, I'm certain if I was a developer, I would try everything I could to develop all four lots separately. So the incentive, it seems as though the county codes, as they're being administered here, don't give a lot of incentive for us to work with the county in our mutual interests here.
Well, I'm going to turn back to staff. We have collectively a lot of experience dealing with the Coastal Commission, you know, I make obviously no promises on an entity that I have no authority over, but I would think that they seeing four potential legal lots go to one legal lot is not, you know, that's not going to raise their blood pressure. And I would defer to staff on the question of whether the Coastal Commission even would take this up. I mean, it's an appeal question, right? It's not
right.
Necessary. It is not a necessary step that the Coastal Commission get involved. It only goes to them should the result be appealed.
That's correct. It unlike a action to amend the local coastal plan, this application would not automatically go up to Coastal Commission. It would only go there on appeal. And my thought was that if the applicant, as part of the request for the two certificates and the two conditional certificates, stated as part of their application that their project description is then to follow up with a voluntary merger action upon issuance of the certificates and the conditional certificates, then that would be what staff would be acting upon.
Bring it as a package.
Bring it as a package.
So if, so with that, I mean, the issue that I have, I've been in Mr. Orton's presence before as he's discussed the legal issues of certificates of compliance, both conditional and unconditional, and it is a complicated legal issue. But in reading his analysis, I have to agree with staff on this, and we're just simply unable to issue unconditional certs of compliance. So my motion, when it's time to make it, will be to deny the appeal and direct staff to work with the applicant to gain. I think everybody from the conversation here understands what that means, and I've spoken to staff, you know, in this discussion about taking the light hand on conditioning the conditioned certificates of compliance. So I think we're headed in the right direction, and you know, I understand your concern.
Yes, I understand, and I appreciate that. And then what I would say from that is that hopefully that would go smoothly and we would not see each other again. And
as much as we enjoy having you here, I would hope for the same. So
always welcome.
And as much as I enjoy the three-hour drive at 6 a.m.
yeah, right.
Other questions, Mr. Gibbons?
I'll leave it to the board, yes.
Ms. Arnold.
I had two. The little tiny lot one, the little part that was sold off or illegally is that going to – I was just worrying about that. Is that – does that belong to someone else? Or?
No, that's all in the title of the core family. And our proposal is to merge, just merge the whole thing. So there's no mess here anymore.
Awesome. Good. And then lastly, I'm asking planning or council, could this appeal be continued so that it would give planning the opportunity to bring back the conditions and then they could make their mind up and be able to see the conditions?
I think the conditions on what they've requested would need to be acted upon. As far as the other conditions for a conditional cert, if they were to ask for that, that would go to the SRB and then come back here on appeal. But there may be another opportunity of having them come in and request unconditional certs for lots 38 and 39 and then do an adjustment that would merge those together and expand to cover the entire property. And that would be a coastal development permit, but that may be something that they want to explore.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could, Mr. Arnold, that was my earlier question. If they're doing essentially a lot line adjustment to expand the unconditional certs to cover the whole 8-plus acres, we don't have to worry about legalizing the other parcels first? I thought we did, for a question.
We do if they're going to be considered a parcel
afterwards
adjusted.
Okay.
We have sometimes in the past included illegal portions as a result of an adjustment.
Okay. So that's a potential path that might be very simple within the future here. So again, defer to colleagues for any questions, and I'm ready with a motion.
Mr. Meacham.
Yeah, I need a little bit of clarity, though. I understand what he was suggesting in terms of putting that one small condition on it, but you said you were concerned about establishing another appeal on that. Why would that be?
I was concerned about directing staff too specifically as to what condition to put on, because when the project is further processed, should it come back to this board on appeal, I want the record clear that I'm approaching any appeal with an open mind. So, general direction.
Jim Horton again. Conditional certificates go to the SRB for initial determination and only come to the board if there's an appeal. And I think that's what Supervisor Gibson was worried about.
An appeal by who?
Who knows? It's
but, I mean, if it seems to me that what they're trying to do is establish much more simplicity here. Why would this?
I think you're right, and I hope you're right, but I
am right.
You're often right, Mr. Meacham. Statistically.
Ms. Arnold.
I'm a little lost in the weeds too. If we can take and give the certificate to the two legal parcels, and then go to the SRB or whatever we're talking about, kind of the lot line adjustment. Merge it out into the illegal parcel. Can't we do the same with our merger program where we have two legal parcels and we're going to expand out to the illegal and just merge it?
The voluntary merger provision only allow voluntary merger of existing legal lots.
But lot line adjustment can be used out to expand out into illegal.
Right.
What the lot line adjustment would do is basically take two legal lots, and you would lot line adjust to one legal lot. It just would be including these two other illegal properties.
And then that one legal lot would be completed with a certificate of compliance.
Right.
Mr. Hinkle?
I believe I have a way around this. I see what part of the hang-up is. Okay. Under your merger ordinance, we could voluntarily merge our two legally created parcels. And as to the illegally created parcels, there are two remedies under the Subdivision Map Act for those. One of those remedies is to issue a conditional certificate of compliance. The other remedy, clearly under 66451.11, the merger and unmerger parcels, B2, was if the parcel was not created in compliance with the applicable laws in effect at the time of its creation, the county has authority to merge it unilaterally.
There you go.
Mr. Orton?
Process. I understand the direction, and I can agree with, you know, trying to resolve this. And if Mr. Orton needs to review what he has just suggested, and it does comply with what our abilities are to accomplish this, does this preclude this? Does this motion preclude that from happening?
No. I implicit in my motion, and maybe it should have been explicit, is to do this in the most efficient, least painful way
possible.
I guess
what I'm looking for is he wouldn't have to come back to us if they can get this resolved.
The reason I'm concerned about the section he cited, there's two portions of the MAP Act. One deal with voluntary mergers, and the other deal with involuntary mergers. And then undoing those, and I think the section that he cited deals with the involuntary merger section, and that's what I have to review.
And as much as I would love to have a further seminar on the subtleties of the Subdivision Map Act, it's really actually a very interesting thing. I think the intention of the board is clear in trying to get to the result that Mr. Hinkle is seeking for his client, and we, of course, want that to happen with the least amount of strain for you and our staff.
Yeah, I just didn't want this to create another hurdle for them to have to go through.
Certainly not my intention.
Okay.
Great. All questions answered. Ms. Arnold?
Sorry. Okay. But to counsel, I guess. So if we place conditions on the, if our conditions were the merge, could that be considered a involuntary merger, and could it be kind of put in under the section that you recited?
That's what he's going
to do. Well, my understanding was that he basically wanted to take the two small parcels and enlarge them, and I would think that the lot line adjustment process would be the easiest way to do that.
I'm just wondering, say that we said he wants those two small lots, they're legal lots, and he wants to merge them, and we place a condition on that merge to include the illegal parcels, it becomes kind of an involuntary.
We cannot condition a merger. We would just merge them together, if that's what he wants.
I think
it sounds to me like he wants to do more than that. He wants to put them together with the rest of the parcel.
Yeah. I think because the result is simple, there should be a pretty direct path to it. And we've talked about a couple of different options here. And so.
Okay.
Okay. Call for the question.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Teixeira?
Yes. Thank you.
Hopefully we can fix it.
Okay.
Thank you very much, board members.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle.
And I do agree, if there's an easier path, it's much more beneficial for the county and the landowners as well. Maybe we'll make one.
Thank you, and have a safe trip back.
Thank you very much.
Okay, moving on. Next item is closed session. Ms. Neal, how long for closed session?
Rita Neal, County Council, about 45 minutes today.
Okay, thank you. Any public comment on closed session? Seeing none, we'll close public comment on closed session, and we are adjourned for today. We'll see everybody back here at 1:30 for report
Chairman.
Out.
After closed session.
Thank you.
We'll come back and report out.